No murders, just kick it, swim, read, take long walks. This'll all be over soon. Hey folks, how you doing? It's Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Just wonderful to have you with me here. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Anna Scotty bring us our first story. It's called Into the Silent Land. Her face was untouched, a pale, creamy oval that nearly glowed in the late afternoon sun, but her head was at an unlikely angle, propped on the curb as if resting on a pillow. Coppery hair spilling all around her shoulders, with the rest of her body in the street, arms and legs flung wide, no blood. I didn't know her, but that wasn't saying much. I'd lived in Solana just a couple of weeks and was keeping a low profile at the behest of my WITSEC handler, a patient fellow named Owen James, who had scooped me out of hot water more than a few times. I was forbidden to work, except for a part-time gig managing the nearly deserted beachfront condo where I had been installed with a new name, a couple of bags of clothing from Old Navy, and a 42-inch flat-screen TV. The clothes were mostly the right size, medium and mostly the right color, black, and, you know, it touched me that Owen had tossed in an end-of-season purple swimsuit with a silly ruffle at the hip and optimistically oversized bra cups. Owen had forgotten shoes. All I had were the battered rainbows I'd been wearing the night I fled L.A., leaving chaos in my wake. No matter about the shoes, I'd been barefoot pretty much since we'd landed at Myrtle Beach International, a moniker that could still make me laugh out loud. Myrtle Beach is a party town, jamming day and night in summer and at spring and winter breaks. Solana, same, but with more drunk locals than giddy college students. I wasn't here for the nightlife. Oh, the beach was gorgeous and just steps from my condo. I planned to use the solitude to get in shape, physically and mentally. The last thing Owen had said to me as he pressed a set of keys, a completely convincing South Carolina driver's license, and a cheap burner phone into my hand was to lie low. "No trouble, Cam," he said solemnly. "I mean, Sonia, sorry. He'd swiped his forehead and rolled his ocean blue eyes dramatically in the universal caricature of confusion. He touched my cheek in a way I'm pretty sure he didn't learn in federal marshal training. "No trouble. No sleuthing, no murders. Just kick it. Swim, read, take long walks. This will all be over soon." That had sounded just fine. In my last WITSEC incarceration, my own stupidity and arrogance had put my best friend's wife and kids in mortal danger and caused my mother to be terrorized by thugs who wouldn't have hesitated to kill her. I never wanted to see L.A. again, and I wanted to forget that Cam Baker, herself a phantasm, had ever existed. I was now Sonia Sutton, 34, a little down on her luck and happy to be managing Serenity Shores, a second-rate property in a third-rate beach town. But Sonia hadn't expected to head out for a late afternoon dip and find the corpse of a young woman sprawled curbside. I squatted and felt for a pulse at her throat. She was gone. So was her purse, if she'd had one. Most likely she had. Her Daisy Duke cutoffs and skimpy halter top didn't provide anywhere to hide, a phone, wallet, or even a set of keys. I considered my options. It was possible that no one had seen me nearly stumble over the girl. I could retreat to my apartment and let someone else find her. On the other hand, If anyone was watching, failure to report a corpse, though not actually a crime in most jurisdictions, tends to make the 5-0 suspicious. I was under strict orders from Owen to do nothing that might draw attention to myself. So? It seemed possible that the girl had slipped and hit her head on the curb. Scantily clad, good-looking girls running around the environs of Myrtle Beach of an evening tended to be drunk, or, well, on their way to that condition. Or perhaps some medical crisis had felled her, despite the serenity of her lovely face. The most likely possibility was that she was mugged. A purse snatcher could have yanked her bag hard enough to knock her down, probably never intending to make himself a murderer in the process. I sighed and stood up. I was forbidden to use my burner cell for anything other than contacting Owen. I'd have to go home and use the landline. Cutting through the guest parking lot the complex provided, I decided to knock on one of the front-facing units and make someone else's number the initial contact. I didn't know all of my tenants yet, but the bright orange door belonged to a new resident I'd signed up myself, Lila Cooper. Mrs. Cooper answered, brushing her hands on a white apron. Her smile was big and genuine, making her seem younger than the crow's feet and silver at her temples might have implied. She had a smudge of flour on her nose, and her condo was redolent with a buttery cinnamon fragrance that made my stomach growl. Yes, Sonia, isn't it? Behind her I saw the clutter of a recent move. Boxes and bags were stacked everywhere. I nodded. I'm sorry to disturb you, but there's been an accident. A young woman. Mrs. Cooper gasped and pushed by me. A little Minnie rolled past, slowing as the driver apparently noticed the girl sprawled in the street, then took off again, barely missing my tenant. I wasn't judging. If there was somebody else on hand, why not let them handle the drama? Mrs. Cooper stood over the girl's body, white-faced, visibly shaking. Oh, thank God, she exclaimed. I blinked. That's not the reaction to a corpse I'd seen before. She must have heard how it sounded and recovered herself quickly. I was afraid. She knelt and touched the girl's soft, pretty face. Oh, poor thing. The poor, poor thing. Her voice trembled. I understood. The first corpse I ever saw was that of my erstwhile best friend, recently strangled by my fiancé. I've seen plenty since, but the first, well, it stays with you. I put my hand on Mrs. Cooper's slender forearm. It's better if you don't touch her, I said gently. You don't know her. She stared at the girl's cameo face, shaking her head slowly. Oh, such a beautiful, pretty thing, that pretty auburn hair. May I use your phone to call for help? Mrs. Cooper nodded, seeming to compose herself. Of course, please, Sonia. But why don't you stay here with her, and I'll go inside and make the call. I understood. It didn't seem right to leave the girl alone. I sat heavily on the curb and sighed as she headed back inside. I've seen too much death, and the truth is you never get used to it all. The police officers who responded were a mismatched pair, a blonde who seemed barely older than our victim, hair pulled back into a prim bun like the one I'd favored in my librarian days, and a rotund black officer, perhaps 20 years her senior, with gold wire-rimmed glasses and a calm manner that commanded respect. They asked me to walk around with the various units with them, identifying what residents I could, though I hadn't been managing the site long enough to know more than a few names and faces. Mrs. Cooper wasn't any help. She'd moved in just a couple of weeks prior and was focused on the imminent arrival of her daughter from Clemson University upstate. A painful divorce had been hinted at but never mentioned outright as she signed the rental papers. Juliet would be coming home to the beachfront condo for the first time at any moment, thus her mother's flowery hands and the cinnamon aromas. The Solana PD probably didn't handle a lot of violent crime. I expected them to shoo me away from the crime scene, assuming it was one, but they seemed to welcome my assistance. I stood guard by the corpse as Goldspex hung caution tape and Prim Bun took photos on her cell phone that I hoped were for official report and not for Instagram. Then Bun and I knocked on all the doors in my own complex, while Spex took the cottage across the street. But no one seemed to know this girl who had died with so little fanfare. Spex agreed that it looked like a purse snatching gone wrong. Low-key muggings are a problem in any tourist town, and in recent weeks they had a spate of crimes committed by kids on bikes. It did seem odd that no one knew the girl. A couple of uniforms had been posted in the parking lot in case one of the stragglers recognized her. Apparently, it wasn't the coroner's first rodeo. He gave the uniformed officers an exasperated look and shooed me to the other side of the caution tape. Beckoning toward the Dodge Charger that was just pulling up, like his car, the detective who climbed heavily out of the Charger had seen better days. He was rumpled, surly sort. He gave the deceased an annoyed glance before chatting briefly with Specs and Bun, who waved vaguely toward me.
Detective Bill Randall, Solana Police Department, he growled as he approached, eyeing my bare feet and baggy yoga pants with disdain.
You found her? I nodded and lifted my chin, meeting his eyes. I've been punched, choked, threatened with a knife, and shot at. I've brewed tea for an infanticidal father, shared a plate of cookies with a murderous middle school librarian, and been chased in and out of 6 or 7 identities by Mateo Andres, my homicidal ex. I wasn't about to be intimidated by a small-town cop with a big-shot attitude.
About 45 minutes ago, I offered, hoping he'd pick up on the implicit criticism of his delayed response time. I was crossing over for a swim, and she was just lying here. I didn't see a purse or a backpack.
He nodded, looking bored. Okay, anyone else around when you found her? I shrugged. Not that I saw.
But she hadn't been dead long. Her skin was warm to the touch, and she still had perspiration at her hairline.
That was dumb, and I knew better. Randall squinted.
You a nurse?
I almost laughed. I don't have to be a medical professional to know people stop sweating when they're dead. I swallowed my retort and made my eyes big like Bambi's.
I mean, I said hesitantly. She looked just like it had just happened, you know?
I let my upspeak indicate feminine uncertainty, and he took the bait, smiling approvingly.
Smart gal, he said. He gave me a business card. You think of anything or hear any gossip about who she might be, you call me. Here?
I nodded. Oh, yes, sir. Heading to the water, I bit my lip. I had to do better in this placement than I'd done in the past. Owen had hinted, or perhaps threatened, that if I brought myself to the attention of law enforcement again, he was going to have to put me in the clink. It didn't seem right. I was the victim of my former lover's crimes, not the perpetrator. But Owen had explained that in the eyes of the law, I was neither victim nor perp. I was a material witness in a federal case, and the Supremes have often reaffirmed the government's right to jail witnesses to safeguard their testimony. It had surprised me at first that sunsets can be as beautiful on the East Coast as they were on the West. From the shore at Solana, you don't actually see the blazing ball of the sun slip below the water, of course. But because the beach is on an inlet and not facing due east, you do see orange and pink and gold streak the sky as the air grows chill. The water is warmer than in L.A., and I'd gotten into the habit of floating on my back just past the break, thinking about what I might want to do with myself after the trial. Thomas Wolfe said, "You can't go home again, And I guess he was right, but I didn't think I could go back to my life as a librarian and PhD candidate. The degree didn't seem important anymore, nor the work I'd once taken such pride in. From time to time I thought of the girl I'd been, prim, bookish, Lori Yarborough, with fondness. But I wasn't her anymore. So who was I? I had not liked cutting hair or working as a health aide. Helping out at a ritzy private school had been fun, but what I'd perhaps enjoyed most was being a personal assistant, and then an organizer. Maybe I liked putting people's affairs in order because my own life was such a big, sloppy disaster. I kicked a little closer to shore and took a deep breath, letting the water lift and cradle me. It was nearly dark, and there were only a few people on the beach, mostly walking their dogs. Laughter rumbled up from a group of college boys chugging Bud Light at the water's edge. I flipped over, did a couple of quick laps, and waded back toward shore, grateful that my ridiculous purple suit was somewhat camouflaged by dusk. The police car and ambulance were gone by the time I rinsed the sand off my feet and crossed back to my apartment. The caution tape, too, and the girl's body. It was as if she'd never existed. As I walked the gravel path to my place, that emanating aroma drifted from Mrs. Cooper's unit again. I'm not too proud to admit. I fantasized that she might drop by with a covered plate, and she did not. I watched hours of crap TV the next afternoon before I decided to make my way into town to get some running shoes and a more practical swimsuit. The little Versa I'd abandoned in Los Angeles hadn't been much, but I missed it now. The best Owen could do this time around was a battered CRV that had rolled off the assembly line back when I was in middle school. It had a torn passenger seat and some patched holes on the driver's side door that looked suspiciously like buckshot. But I had a couple grand in cash I'd saved for my last gig, and the little stipend Owen had arranged was enough that I didn't have to use my stash to live on. After a quick swim and a shower, shadows were gathering as I hopped in the CRV. I headed west, looking for a big box store where I could grab some staples and maybe a cheap tablet so I could download a few books. The megastore I found smelled like cheap dye and child labor, but the prices were good. I ignored my conscience and scooped up a plain black swimsuit, no ruffle, thank you, and a couple of pairs of tennis shoes, socks, underwear, fresh towels, and some toiletries. A refurbished tablet was a steal at $200, and I threw in a bottle of Sauv Blanc, a bag of apples, a wedge of cheese, and a loaf of bread. I knew I'd regret not stocking up better later, but I was restless and eager to get back on the highway. Being around so many people made me nervous. The store was huge and lit up like daylight, if daylight were green and made people look like they'd been embalmed. There was nowhere to hide. No, the big ladies in pastel shorts pushing overloaded shopping carts didn't seem likely to be paid assassins, nor did the families laughing and grabbing bags of chips and cases of soda, or the bored cashiers. Nonetheless, somebody was hunting me. Somebody wanted me, dead or alive. Alive, I suspected. The last minion he'd sent for me had tried to force me into his sedan at gunpoint, when he could have just blown me to smithereens with a Desert Eagle 44 the size of a toaster. "Well, thank you," the pretty cashier told me, cramming the last of my stuff into a big plastic bag. "Come on back now, here." Her sugary tone made me laugh, and she lifted one well-waxed eyebrow. "Ma'am?" And that was another thing. "Ma'am?" I was 34, not 84. Well, but time was slipping away. My biggest worry had once been whether to take my future husband's name once I earned my doctorate. Now I worried that the lazy-looking security guard in the parking lot might be a killer in disguise sent by Mateo. I'd been a silly thing, despite the years of grueling study, despite my name on several scholarly articles and the university teaching offers. I'd been the worst kind of fool a woman can be. A fool for love. Sometimes I miss that fool. I gathered up my bags and left the store. He was so still, there in the shadows of my little fenced patio, that I didn't see him until I'd set my bags down and gotten the key into the door. "Bang," he said, and I shrieked like a kindergarten girl. Handsome, virile, and only slightly dorky, Owen James paid by the U.S. government to keep me safe until I could testify in the trial of Mateo's cartel. "Now, if I'd been an actual bad guy, Sonia, you'd have real trouble on your hands," Owen said, getting up. I grinned, admiring his formidable physique in the dim glow of the patio light. There wasn't enough light to see whether Owen's eyes were still the color of the waves off Point Dune, but he was wearing his signature bow tie with a blue button down and khakis. Somehow, that outfit hadn't looked as good when my dad had worn it. "A little trouble sounds great right about now," I told him. Owen looked away, and I'm pretty sure it was to hide a blush. He picked up my packages and followed me into the apartment. "So," I said, grabbing a couple of Coronas from the fridge and motioning him toward the dilapidated plaid couch I'd inherited from the last manager. "There must be news about the trial, or you wouldn't be here." Owen got up fast. No, I'm sorry. No news. I didn't mean to mislead you. I just..." "Please," I told him. "I do not mind your checking up on me. Lately, the only time I'm not bored and lonely is when I'm scared." He looked uncertain. I ought to go. I had a few hours between flights. Are you well? Do you need anything?" I set my beer down and stood facing him. I put my palms flat on Owen's chest, very lightly. "Please, don't go. I'm really awfully lonely." He was tall, and I had to stand on tiptoes to reach his lips. But when I finally got there, Owen took both of my wrists in one hand, holding me at a distance from him, and turned his face away. "This is wrong," he said firmly. "My fault, Sonia. I apologize. Maybe someday when this is over." I sighed. "Yeah, if it's ever over. Listen, Owen, as long as you're here, I should..." I was going to tell him about the girl in the road. I swear I was. But at that moment, a sharp rap at the door startled us both. Owen pushed me behind him with his right hand and touched the Sig Sauer P250 at his hip with his left. "It's okay," I whispered. "I am the manager, you know. Somebody's probably locked out." Owen nodded but didn't speak, motioning me into the kitchenette. He went to the door, looked through the peephole, and turned to me with a look of fury before letting his jacket drop back over his cig and opening the door to Detective Bill Randall, SBPD, holding his shield before him like a shield. The two sized each other up. Maybe it was a cop smelling cop. Maybe it was just two alpha dogs. But the air fairly crackled between them. "Detective," I said, "please meet my friend, Marshall, from out of town." Detective Randall introduced himself, and the men stared each other down. "Are you in some kind of trouble, Sonia?" Owen asked. I could nearly hear his teeth grinding. Randall glanced at me, amused, probably writing Owen off as an overprotective boyfriend. "No, she's only a witness at this point, not that we've ruled anything out." I explained quickly, and Owen seemed to relax. Surely he could see that I hadn't invited trouble this time. All the same, it had found me. "The coroner had ruled the Vic's death a homicide," Randall told me. "We don't have an ID on her as yet, but we've got some potential perps in mind, so I may need you to come downtown to look at photos." He glanced at Owen, then back to me. "Don't leave town." Photos of what? I objected. I'm just the PR. She was dead when I found her. Randall lifted one eyebrow, wrinkling his forehead, which gave him a distinctly bloodhound-like appearance.
The PR?
Now he knew, and I knew he knew, and he knew I knew he knew that PR means person reporting. I bit my lip, not daring to glance at Owen.
I'm sorry, I said finally. I read a lot of murder mysteries. Person reporting, actually, I wasn't even the one who called it in.
Randall nodded, handing me another card. And one for you, Mr., Owen smiled genially.
Taylor, he said. Marshall Taylor.
Randall left, Owen close behind him, and the apartment seemed hollow without their big presences. I'd never been completely enamored of my rescued greyhounds, but they'd been company on lonely nights. Vindy, adopted from a client I'd sent to prison, had barely tolerated me, although in the end she'd died a hero, taking a bullet intended for a 2-year-old who'd adored her. Mimi had liked me all right. I wondered how he was doing, and hoped that someone had found a place for him. I'd forgotten to ask Owen in the rush of his visit. I missed Mimi's soft panting and the click of his nails on my hardwood floors. I missed the hardwood floors, too. Whoever had furnished Serenity Shores was a stalwart fan of cheap beige carpet. It'd be safer to live with a dog, too, but I didn't want to be responsible for another life right now. I was working hard enough to keep myself in the present tense. I almost expected the soft tap at the door 15 minutes after the men had left. Owen, I said softly to myself, rushing to the door. It didn't occur to me that it would be anyone else, but I used the peephole from force of habit. Mrs. Cooper stood nervously on my stoop. She wasn't holding a plate of cookies either.
"Well, I know it's late. I'm sorry," she mumbled when I opened the door. "Please, I don't know anyone else here, and I'm awfully worried."
I ushered her in and offered her a seat at the dinette. She waved away the Corona I offered, so I popped it open for myself.
"It's my daughter," she said anxiously. "Juliet, she doesn't answer her cell. The dorms are closed, and she should have been here by now." She said she'd drive down on Monday.
My eyes met her. They were red-rimmed and almost welling over.
Well, this is Wednesday, I said stupidly,
as if she had no access to a calendar. It made sense now. This was why she'd been so frantic when I'd knocked on the door with news of a dead girl in the street.
Juliet has friends in Columbia, Mrs. Cooper explained. She was thinking of giving them a ride, so it's possible staying the night, so I wasn't really concerned.
She held her hands out, palms up.
She's independent. We're close, but she'll go a few days without calling, so I don't worry. But now?
Clemson was in the northwest corner of the state, and Myrtle Beach on the southeastern coast. I figured it would have been a 4-5-hour drive. It made sense that the girl might have stopped over with friends. She'd probably just forgotten to check in. Except that we'd found another girl dead in the road the previous day. One girl dead, one girl missing from the same location in the course of less than 2 days would be quite a coincidence. And I'm not big on coincidence. As Sherlock Holmes put it, the universe is rarely so lazy.
"Oh, I wouldn't worry too much, Mrs. Cooper," I lied. "Have you checked with her friends?"
I don't know them," she confessed with a guilty look. "Not even their names."
"Well, it's okay," I assured her. "A lot of parents wouldn't."
"Have you checked with hospitals, the police?"
"I've called all the hospitals between Clemson and Myrtle Beach," she said firmly. "Nothing. I tried campus security, and they'd only tell me her room is locked and her car is gone. The police," she pressed a knuckle to her mouth nervously.
I don't, I am I too traumatic?"
Juliet is 19. She's not a little girl. They say you can't make a report until the person's been missing 24 hours. I don't know how long Juliet's been missing. I don't know if she even is missing.
They watch too much TV, I told her firmly. There's no waiting period before you can report someone missing. Of course, the police can't make a 19-year-old come home. She's an adult. But they could certainly look for her and put your mind at ease.
Mrs. Cooper put her arms around herself and rocked slightly. It was a sad thing to see. She was comforting herself like a monkey alone in a cage. I've been alone myself. I knew I ought to sit by her and maybe put my arm around her. But I'm just not the touchy-feely type. Maybe I had been once.
We haven't always been on great terms, she explained. My divorce, it came too late. Juliet grew up with a lot of fighting and a lot of arguing. She was so happy to get away to college. But we've been talking a lot. She promised to come home for break. Well, to come here. This isn't home yet. But
I set my beer down. Friction in the family was good news. Juliet had probably decided to give herself a break and spend a few days partying.
Could she be with her father? I asked.
Mrs. Cooper stopped rocking and met my eyes.
Oh, goodness, no, she said firmly. Julia and I have our issues, but she wants absolutely nothing to do with her father, believe you me.
At the same time, I said, the police will want his contact info. Tell you what, why don't you head home, write down his name and number, and try to think of any of Juliet's friends you can remember. Even first names are okay. Write it all down. The number's for campus security, too. I'll phone Detective Randall. Remember, the one who was here about the...
Mrs. Cooper's eyes grew panicked.
About the accident, I said firmly. I'll ask him to meet me at your place, and I'll help you explain the situation to him.
She nodded, and I stood up.
I appreciate it, Sonia, she said gratefully.
I put in a quick call to Randall, who sounded annoyed as usual, but agreed to come back.
Eh, I got news anyway, he said gruffly. Tell you when I get there.
Mrs. Cooper had her patio light on, and she'd propped a desk lamp in the living room window like a beacon to welcome her daughter home. She offered me coffee, but I carried my half-drunk beer over. The living room was a mirror image of my own, but a mess. Moving boxes were piled against one wall with a few empties flattened and leaning against the sofa. A blue suitcase and a canvas duffel occupied the only comfortable chair, an overstuffed green recliner. So I took a seat at the dinette and helped myself to a cookie from the platter stacked high.
Oh, I've just begun to unpack, Mrs. Cooper said with an embarrassed smile. I've been focused on the kitchen, getting everything nice and bacon and...
Her voice trailed away and she knotted her hands together.
I'm just so worried. That girl in the street, she seemed to be Juliet's age. What if...
I knew where she was going.
No, doesn't make sense, I said firmly.
That girl was probably killed by accident during a mugging. Muggers don't kidnap, or worse, not purposefully.
She nodded, taking a stack of folded towels from a cardboard box. She smoothed them flat and set them on the counter beside a blue plastic soap dish and a box of Kleenex. I leaned over and pulled a medium-sized carton toward me.
May I help?
She nodded, and I slit the tape on the box with my thumbnail. Picture frames.
Where do you want this? I asked, taking a polished copper frame from the box. It was a blown-up color snapshot of an older couple, Mrs. Cooper's parents, probably.
The woman's red hair streamed across her face, and she beamed at whoever had taken the picture, as the bespectacled man gazed at her, also smiling.
Mrs. Cooper frowned, considering,
Well, that one, it could go on the side table by the green chair. Do you mind?
I got up and set the photo on the table.
What about this luggage? Can I put it in the bedroom?
I tapped the blue suitcase, and she gave me an odd look. squinting her eyes at the suitcase as if she'd never seen eyes on it before.
No, she said finally. You can just leave that. Let's just try and get a few of these boxes unpacked. That would be such a help, Sonia.
I shrugged and checked my watch. Detective Randall was taking his time. I took another picture from the box and set it on the table. Sonia reached for it, smiling faintly.
My university graduation, she said, shyly.
That doesn't need to be out. I put that in the closet. She set the frame on top of the towels and carried it all out of eyesight. I heard her open the linen closet in the hall. I got up and crossed the room. Something about the photo of Lila's parents was bothering me. I rubbed a tarnished mark with my thumb and sat down again. I took a third frame from the box. This one was carefully wrapped. Just as I parted the tissue, there was a firm rap at the door, and Mrs. Cooper hurried out to answer. I heard Randall's deep baritone, but as if from some great distance, as blood rushed in my ears, the face looking up from the bright silver frame was young and lovely, with sparkling green eyes and auburn hair. The girl's face was a perfect oval, pale as cream, a cameo.
Juliet,
I whispered, touching the cold glass with one finger. Mrs. Cooper came into the room with Randall trailing behind. His eyes took in the boxes, the luggage, the platter of cookies, the frame I held out.
This is Juliet, I said dully.
Mrs. Cooper smiled.
Yes, my beautiful girl. That was taken last summer on our tour of Clemson.
I met Randall's eyes, and he took the framed picture, realization dawning.
This is your daughter? This girl?
Mrs. Cooper looked confused.
Yes, of course. That's my Juliet. She's the reason we asked you to come. Of course, it's probably nothing, but she...
She trailed off.
She should have come home by now. She should have come home on Monday.
Randall crossed the room, pulled a sweatshirt from the open duffel, and held it up. It was a peach hoodie. The Clemson Tigers were printed in white letters across the front. He pulled out a pair of sweat socks, a handful of lacy thongs.
Mrs. Cooper, he said flatly. She did come home on Monday, didn't she? These are Juliet's things. She's been here.
Mrs. Cooper looked from him to me, her eyes wild and panicked, like a trapped animal's.
No, she said. I don't know. I feel very strange. I need to lie down.
The girl on the street, Randall went on. That was this girl. That was your daughter.
He held up the picture and she stared at it, horrified, shaking her head slowly back and forth.
Why do you lie?
I stood up. I think that's enough, I said firmly. Leave her alone. What was he going to do, arrest me for not being a bully? I went to Mrs. Cooper and put my arms around her shoulders, guiding her to the sofa.
I've read about this, I've told the detective. Dissociative amnesia.
He snorted. Amnesia? She knows who she is. I shook my head.
Selective amnesia. It can be brought on by stress, by trauma. It's something that the conscious mind can't accept to be true.
Mrs. Cooper was making a soft, pained sound like a keening of a wounded animal.
So she forgot what her own daughter looked like? Randall said doubtfully.
She didn't recognize her own kid?
I would have continued, but Mrs. Cooper had begun to scream. She kept screaming until the paramedics had come and gone, taking her away on a stretcher as if it were her body that was broken, not her heart. I could hear her shrieks in my head long after they'd driven away. I saw through the open French doors that lights had popped on throughout the complex. Randall stayed behind, still holding the framed photograph, shaking his head.
You okay? He said at last.
I was thinking of a sonnet I'd loved since high school. Remember me when I am gone away, gone far away into the silent land. Randall wasn't going to be interested in a lesson on Christiana Rossetti. I chugged the last half inch of my beer.
It was time to go home to my own empty apartment, my own silent land. The detective walked me across the yard to my unit.
"Well, I think we have the guy," he offered as I fumbled with my key. "A kid, as suspected, 15. Kid on a bike, snatching bags, couple of uniforms caught him grabbing a purse from a lady down on State Drive an hour ago. Didn't have any of our girls' stuff on him. Says he threw it in the canal, but he fessed up to everything. Scared straight, the little punk."
"That won't help," I told him. "That won't help anyone."
He snorted. "Well, it'll help the next lady. The one he would have knocked down and killed next."
He had a point, but I was suddenly very tired.
"Do you really think it's possible," he continued, "to forget your own kid? I mean, I got three, and they can be little pains in the butt, but they live with their moms, and I'm pretty sure I'd recognize them dead in the street."
I went inside and shut the door without answering. The wall clock ticked. From the bathroom, the dripping of the faucet hadn't quite shut off. I'd let the French doors open, and a fresh breeze wafted through the dark room. Had I left them open? Now I couldn't remember. I was usually pretty good about locking up tight. It was not too late to slip back into the patio and call to Randall. Instead, I eased into the kitchen without turning on the light, thinking of the rusted butcher knife that rested in the silverware drawer, along with a bottle opener and a jumble of plastic forks.
"It's just me," Owen said softly from where he stood by the sink. "A Corona in one hand. I came back to say goodnight. I heard your neighbor screaming, but Inspector Bloodhound was already on the scene, so..."
"Inspector Bloodhound." I laughed, and then, horribly, I began to cry. Owen put his beard down and opened his arms. I fell against him as if I'd always belonged there. He smelled like shaving cream and faintly like the ocean. His chest was as hard as a brick wall, a wall I could lean on, a wall that could shelter me.
"I came back to tell you I'm being reassigned," he said. "I won't be your primary anymore. You'll hear from the new guy by tomorrow afternoon."
I looked up at him. What do you mean? You said we were close to taking Mateo to trial. Owen, I thought this was nearly over."
Owen nodded. It is. It should be. Your new handler will fill you in. I'm off your case, and not free to discuss it with you." He bit his lip, that plump pillow I often fantasized about nibbling. "My flight's in 2 hours out of Wilmington. I've got to go." I pressed harder against him, refusing to hear. He tipped my chin up, forcing me to meet his eyes, and smiled ruefully. "I'll miss you, Sonia. Please, Owen, please call me Lori." I hated the plaintive, raw quality of my own voice. "Just this one time, call me by my real name." He brushed a strand of hair from my eyes, then cupped my face in his two hands. I thought he was going to kiss me, finally. I closed my eyes, but his lips brushed my forehead, soft as the wings of a bird. "I will," he said softly.
"I will, Sonia. Someday."
That's the second or the third in the installment of that author and that woman in this character. I think it's a good story. I think she does a very nice job with it. All right, I'm going to stay in the exact same Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, just down a few pages to a story by Tarina Elizabeth Bell that's called Little Jim.
Do you do this often, Sheriff? Dropping by people's house? Because I don't think you do, leastways. I've never seen it. I ain't seen you come down to anybody's house. You always send your deputies. At least that's what I've seen on TV. This will be on TV, right? The body? I found it right over there beside that bush. The county water's coming and getting ready to come in, and you know those signs, call before you dig. Well, my Aunt Leanie said that means know where your power line is. So when construction comes, they don't cut it. So I thought, I'll dig for where the line is. That way, when they do come, I can show them. Well, I went to buy those tiny flags, you know, by the side of the road, them little red ones, but American flags was all they had, like children wave. And I thought, well, my yard sure will look patriotic. Hey, Sheriff, would you mind if I got a picture of you and me by them flags? No, sir, I don't want to get in the way of the scene, but if we were just turned a little, we wouldn't. Your man right there, he has a camera here. Let's let him take it. Okay, Sheriff, say cheese. Okay, I'll get back to it. I dug to see where the electric line was so I could mark it with those flags. I thought the bush could be a marker. I started yesterday morning and dug and dug until my back, well, it got to hurting, and I thought I better quit. If I'd already dug that far, there wasn't nothing there, and it was time to move on elsewhere. My Aunt Leanie always said that. Move on. Time to move on, little Jim. She didn't want me stuck in the past. No, she wanted a future for me. So, there I was a-digging, and I decided to take a break, and then that's when I saw it. Guess what I saw? I saw a watch. I seen this man's watch shining up through the dirt. It was shining and a-glinting like sunlight could bounce right off that watch into the trees. And I thought, well, now what's that doing there? I said, little Jim, what's that man's watch doing buried in your yard? And that's when I saw his arm. It was buried down more, and I got on my knees, and I reached, and I tugged, and Sheriff, there was a skeleton down there. A skeleton hand and a skeleton arm, and the rest of the skeleton, too. And when I saw that, an entire man, well, I wished I could tell my Aunt Leanie. She always knew what to do, so I thought of my Aunt Leanie, and I thought what she'd say. She'd say, little Jim, call the police. So I dialed 911, and here you are. It's nice of you to come and check on me, but I'm not afraid. You might think his ghost would bother me, but if that man's spirit was a-haunting, well, he would have already done it. He'd have been a-haunting me for years, all those years I lived here saying, little Jim, you go out there in that yard and find me. When my Aunt Leanie was alive, she said something. Sometimes that she could hear the walls a-creaking, but it was just the settling of the house. She'd say, little Jim, it's got bones, and these bones is a-tired. Aunt Leanie was down in her back a lot. Like me, it runs in the family. This house has been in our family a real long time, but not everybody in our family was good to me. Aunt Leanie was. Everywhere we'd go, she'd say, meet my nephew, little Jim, my nephew, like she was proud. Oh, I sure do miss my Aunt Leanie. She loved me an awful heap and told me what to do. Well, I remember this one time, them floorboards got to creaking. It was so bad, I told Aunt Leanie, I love you, but I'm afraid of your house. And Aunt Leanie got that wind chime. Put it right there on the porch to keep bad spirits away. But no, I did not know that man was there. I promise, Sheriff. Take my word. I miss my Aunt Leanie. She was a good woman. She left school to work on the farm. That way Mama could finish. She was my mama's sister, and after mama died, well, my Aunt Laney was all I had. She left me this house, said I was as good as her son, wrote that right inside her will. She gave me everything. Me and Miss Ellen, that's Aunt Laney's friend, she comes and brings me meals. But Aunt Laney told me not to work the stove. 6 years ago, May, the week right before my birthday, and now you've done gone and made me sad. I was so happy for you to visit, and now you've made me sad. Oh, the body. Yes, sir, you're right. No, I don't want a deputy questioning me, not when I get to talk to you. Yes, I'll try. That's what Aunt Laney said. Other people ain't got the patience. They ain't got the patience, little Jim, but you're being patient with me. What else do you want to know? No, sir. I didn't take nothing. I even left the watch. Wait until the police arrive. That's what they taught in school, especially on the scene of a crime. Well, it is a crime. I don't know how that man got there, but he didn't bury himself. Somebody put him in Aunt Laney's yard. 'Cause when you die, the way you're supposed to, you get put in a casket and there's a stone and everything. Aunt Laney has this beautiful lining and bright-colored flowers. I got to pick it out, me and Miss Ellen, who makes my meals. Good friends, yes. They did things together all the time. Since they moved to town. Miss Ellen and Miss Ellen's husband, the one who disappeared. My Aunt Laney said he didn't disappear, he just moved away. Stop telling people that, little Jim. Someone will think you mean it. But I did. One day he was here. The next day he was not. But, no, didn't nobody miss him. He was a mean man and a half. He yelled when I rode my bike past his house to go the F away, except he didn't say F. He used the bad word. Once I saw him hit Miss Ellen. He laid hands on her. Then he pushed her into a wall. So I told my Aunt Laney. She went right over and yelled, and then he called me the R word. He said, "You keep that R out of my face." And Aunt Laney said, "Don't you call him that." And he said, "You and that R need to mind your own D business." Then he called me that again. I was glad to see him gone. 7 years ago, June, a year before Aunt Laney died. No, I told you, I don't know how long that skeleton's been in the yard. I just found it here today. If I found him before, I would have called before. I called as soon as I found him. I didn't even wash my hands. Why, yes, it is real fertile. The grass is greener over there. The grass is always greener. Get it? But it wasn't that way before. Not before. Aunt Laney planted her bush. No, it used to be ugly. Wouldn't anything grow. That one day I came over real early in the morning, and there was Aunt Laney a-digging in the yard, fertilizer and manure like no tomorrow. And she says, "I've decided to put a snowball bush there, little Jim. Wouldn't that be nice?" Same week she got the wind chimes. When did the TV people get here? Aw, oh, man, I was hoping Channel 6, at least. Did you call? Well, if you don't call, Sheriff, how are they going to know you're here? Well, maybe I should call. I don't mind. But I want everyone to know it's not every day you get a visit from the sheriff. Sure, you can borrow it. Onto the porch. If your man finds that electric wire, would you let the water people know? Oh, no. What's he doing? No, no, y'all stop that. I did not say you could do that. I may have dug beside her bush, but your man is digging up her bush. That's different. That was my Aunt Laney's bush, and Sheriff, I hate to do this. You know, I'm a fan, but I can't let y'all do that. Do not dig up that bush. Oh, no, no, stop, stop. I say, I wish Aunt Laney was here. I should call Miss Ellen. She's at work, but she won't mind. Call me if you need something, little Jim. That's what she always says. She wouldn't let y'all hurt that bush. Hold on a minute. I got the number memorized. First Bank and Trust on Jefferson in town, the one with the clock that's ahead a minute. No, I do need to call if you're going to hurt that bush. Okay, that's good. I won't disturb her. That bush just meant so much to Aunt Leanie. She always told me you leave that bush when I'm gone. I sure do set a store by it. Funny how that man was right over there. You think she'd have found him herself. I'd like to go wash my hands. Will you still be here when I get back? Now promise me you won't dig up that bush. Sheriff, I don't believe you. You said y'all would not do that. I wasn't in that house for more than 2 seconds. How come y'all do that? You told me y'all would not do that. That wasn't very nice. I'm calling Miss Ellen. I don't want that picture anymore. Just 1 minute. You can ask her yourself. I'm calling Miss Ellen now. Miss Ellen? Yeah. This is little Jim. I need your help. The sheriff is here, and he borrowed my shovel, and I went inside to wash my hands, and he started digging up Aunt Leanie's bush, that one she loved with the... Yes? Yes, ma'am? Yes? Am I a suspect? Miss Ellen said to ask. I don't know. He won't say. I'm afraid this may be my fault. I found a man who was buried in the yard. Yes, ma'am. I should have told you. I dug to see where the electric wire was before they came in to put in the county water. Yes, ma'am. He's in front of me. Hold on. I'll give him the cordless phone. Here. What's she saying? What's that she telling you? Sheriff, put it on speaker. I want to hear. Hey, come back. You got my phone. Why are you men leaving? Where are you going, Sheriff? Why'd you put those lights on? You give me back my phone. Well, now that's pretty rude. You make me pick it off the ground, rope my yard, then leave. I know I'm not the smartest, but my Aunt Leanie said I try. And something is going on here. Y'all aren't going to... No, I don't know anything more. I'm not telling you anything more. Not until you tell me what's going on. Sheriff, tell the truth. You talk to me. You tell me what she said. What Miss Ellen said. Sheriff, you tell me what was said. You tell me what I said. Oh, Aunt Leanie, I didn't mean it. Aunt Leanie, what have I done?
Well, friends, I'm out of time. This is Keith Tyler saying thank you for tuning in to the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Join me again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.